The Tudor History and Travel Show is a podcast that brings Tudor history to life by exploring Tudor places and artifacts in the flesh. You will be travelling through time with Sarah Morris, the Tudor Travel Guide, uncovering the stories behind some of the most amazing Tudor locations and objects in the UK. Because when you visit a Tudor building, it is only time and not space which separates you from the past. And now over to your host, Sarah Morris.
Hello, my time-travelling friends. It's Sarah, the Tudor Travel Guide, back to host another episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. Now, before we get into this month's episode, and we are travelling not too far away from where I live, up to the historic town of Warwick to explore the glorious Lord Leicester building, I just wanted to make a couple of announcements. The most important of those is that I have just launched, in association with Adam Pennington, both of us co-founders of Simply Tudor Tours, an online programme called The Rise and Fall of Anne Boleyn. Over the course of just over 2.5 months, Adam and I will be co-hosting a series of live lectures, interviews, and obviously associated Q&As with a number of different historians and historical researchers who have a passion for Anne Boleyn. And our aim is to be exploring perhaps some of the less often slightly quirky subjects associated with Anne, such as the rise of the Boleyns, her cosmopolitan circle of friends, the transition between the households of Catherine of Aragon and Anne Boleyn, her coronation and how Henry chose and tried to assert her God-given right as his queen consort, the accusations of witchcraft laid against Anne Boleyn at her fall in May 1536, and also specifically her trial as an engine of state rather than a mechanism to try or test the guilt of the accused. And finally, a live interview with author Sandra Vasoli about her latest research on the letter purportedly written by Anne Boleyn from the Tower. If you want to find out more details about each of these sessions and our wonderful speakers, as well as a couple of digital giveaways that we will be gifting to anybody who registers for the programme, then simply check out the link in the description associated with this podcast that will take you through to the information and also to the booking page on our Simply Tudor Tours website. Speaking of Simply Tudor Tours, I just want to give a very, very quick heads up that booking will be opening for the first of our 2025 tours in May, the 19th of May to be precise. We aim to run three tours in 2025, and the one that's running in May of that year is the first one up, and it is called Anne and Elizabeth, Mother, Daughter, Traitors, Queens. Now, booking is not yet open, but if you're not as yet registered on our VIP mailing list but are interested in our tours, then again, just check out the link in the description and you will be able to subscribe to that list and be among the first people to find out when booking opens, because we do open booking to our VIP list 1 week before it opens to the general public. Okay, well, I think that's all I need to say with regards to our general public announcements for this month. It is time to go time travelling. Now, as I said, I didn't have to go far to record this episode, but as you will know if you followed me for any length of time, I have been urging people to visit the historic town of Warwick for a number of reasons. There are three fantastic historic locations there. Of course, there is the castle. Then you have the Beauchamp Chapel at St Mary's Parish Church. And then the third gem, the third jewel in the crown for Warwick, is the Lord Leicester. Now, as you will hear in this podcast, the Lord Leicester recently underwent a major renovation project, which was completed and open to the visitors last year. And I had the opportunity to nip along to Warwick and to meet with their master, Heidi Mayer, who, of course, will introduce her role and take us on a deep dive into the history of the Lord Leicester as we tour the buildings together. Just before we begin, I'd like to remind all of you that there is a show notes page associated with this podcast where we have included many images of the rooms and the spaces which are under discussion. It is well worth checking out. So yes, look for the link in the description associated with this podcast. We'll also be including a link to the Lord Leicester's website, so you can find out more about them directly from there. And also, of course, if you're planning a visit, you'll be able to check out any relevant visitor information. Right, well, with that, I give you the Lord Leicester in Warwick. So welcome, dear listener, to this month's episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. And I find myself just a short way up the road, actually, from where I live. And I am in the town of Warwick in Warwickshire. And I'm visiting a place that's been on my list for quite some time, the Lord Leicester in Warwick, which is a building which has a history that spans over 900 years. And I'm here today to explore that history with our guest and master of the Lord Leicester, Heidi. Hi, Heidi. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Sarah. Well, welcome to the Lord Leicester.
It'd be lovely if you could just say a few words of introduction about yourself and what is a master of the Lord Leicester?
So the masters of the Lord Leicester were first installed here in the reign of Elizabeth I. And my predecessors span a period of about 400 years. The first master was Ralph Griffin, installed in 1571. And he was followed shortly thereafter by a really controversial figure called Thomas Cartwright. And since then we've had 33 masters. I'm the 33rd master and the first female master. And I live here at the Lord Leicester in the master's house. And my job is to run the charity, make sure that our extremely precious heritage site is looked after and is still standing, and to welcome visitors and guests to the Lord Leicester. My other task is, of course, is to look after the brethren, who are the retired soldiers and wounded warriors who live here within our charity, our charitable mission, who live here at the Lord Leicester.
So a couple of things I just want to point out. I mean, it is one of the most magnificent of the heritage buildings in Warwick. If anybody comes here and they wander down the high street, they'll see this beautiful timber-framed building towards the end of the high street, close to where the west gate of the town used to be back in the day, I understand.
Oh, the west gate's still there.
Kind of still there, really,
isn't
it?
It's still there.
It's quite magnificent.
Yeah, pedestrians walk under it. But the Lord Leicester, it is an extraordinary building. And I'll let you into a little secret. When I was contemplating the job, whether I'd like to be master here, one of the decisions that helped me on my way was that I literally fell in love with the buildings. I saw them as I walked down the high street of Warwick, and they are absolutely beautiful. These beautiful half timbered buildings with this honey coloured limestone wattle and daub, and straight out of the Middle Ages.
They really are.
They really are. And they were built in the Middle Ages, but they became really of great prominence in the period, in the Tudor period.
And the other thing I just wanted to note is I reckon that many of our listeners will notice you have a little twang of an accent. You're American, aren't you? Or that's you British by birth, but lived in America for a long time?
Yes, I was born in Britain, but I spent most of my adult life working and living in the United States. I have an American husband, American children, and in some ways I have a very American outlook about things.
Yes, well, as I think I was mentioning before we started recording, many of our listeners are from the US, so they'll be very interested in your background.
So the other thing that I think would be quite useful to state up front was the original purpose of this building. And you were mentioning about the Brethren, and perhaps you could just give us a top line summary of what the purpose of this building actually is and how it came about.
Yes, it's a question a lot of people ask. Of course, I think I have to give you a little bit of background about this, about what was going on in the Tudor age. When Elizabeth I inherited the throne, Britain was in a turmoil. And a large part of that was because of Elizabeth's father's, Henry VIII's, policies on dissolution of the monasteries and the Reformation policies. Because what it created by the time Elizabeth became queen was a lot of very poor people living on the streets. It's estimated there was probably about 150,000 people that had been tipped out of monasteries and religious buildings that were actually homeless in England. And when Elizabeth came to the throne, Lord Burghley said to her, "Ma'am, if you don't do something about the homeless and the poverty on the streets, we're going to have a civil war in England." And so Elizabeth went in her usual manner, practical manner, "I have to do something about it." And she really did. She started by supporting the poor laws, passed and supported a lot of the poor laws passed by Parliament. And it created really the responsibility of parishes to create places, philanthropic places, where people deserving poor of the Tudor period could come and live and be looked after. And it was really important in Tudor Britain to get these people off the streets. And the places that each parish created were the name of the places they called them hospitals. So not in the modern sense of a hospital, but derived from the word of hospitality, and to look after people and to care for the deserving poor of Tudor England. And so it was on this foundation, these sort of political origins, that hospitals were created throughout Britain. And we, the Lord Leicester, its full name is the Hospital of Robert Dudley, Earl of Leicester. So it is, in short, it's often referred to as the Lord Leicester Hospital. We refer it to as the Lord Leicester. Mm-hmm. So Robert Dudley he's one of the leading proponents of Puritanism in England. But not only that, we all know that he was very interested in developing his very intimate relationship with the Queen, and in fact very much wanted to marry her. And I don't know, this is a personal spin on it, but I don't know whether he wanted to impress her. But he rode out from Kenilworth one day from his big castle. He rode into Warwick deliberately looking for an impressive building where he could create and found one of these philanthropic institutions that the Tudors referred to as hospitals. And he rode into Warwick, saw the buildings at the time. They belonged to the guilds of Warwick, these extraordinary, beautiful buildings that they had built in the late 1300s, and must have decided, that's impressive enough for me, I want those buildings, and managed to persuade the guilds of Warwick to give him their buildings. He was, of course, extremely influential in England. He was extremely well known, very prominent, had this very, very close relationship with the Queen. The guilds were hardly in a position to say no to him. So he acquired the buildings, and on Boxing Day in 1571, the guilds moved out and Robert Dudley moved in. He installed the master and 12 brethren to live here, and that was the beginning of the Lord Leicester. And we have occupied the buildings ever since, with the master and the brethren living here and creating the community that still endures to this day.
It's remarkable. I love it. And I'm particularly here now because I know you've come to the end of a huge restoration, or you're towards the end of a very large restoration project. And what we're going to do today is go and have a wander around and have a look around, and you're going to take us on the visitor route, because of course people can come and visit the Lord Leicester. So we're going to be seeing the different spaces that people can come and visit for themselves.
Bearing in mind my my life in the States, it was extraordinary that in the 1800s, this was one of the most popular places for American tourists to come and visit.
That's incredible.
They would come to the castle, but then on their list was the Lord Leicester. So from the 1800s, this site became very popular with American tourists. And I think it had a lot to do with Nathaniel Hawthorne. And Nathaniel Hawthorne was an American diplomat based in Leamington Spa. And he liked to come here to Lord Leicester and sit in the gardens. And he published a book called Our Old Home. And his writing really portrayed it as probably the real McCoy in terms of medieval buildings. And he spent time talking about the Brethren, these old worthies that would be sitting outside in their Tudor robes, smoking their pipes. And he described all of this in great detail. And I think it must have absolutely captured the imagination of Americans who had this vision and view of what medieval England might be like. And of course, this is the Victorian era when the Gothic world and all things Gothic are really important. So you not only have a Victorian love of the Gothic world, but then you actually have the real deal, the real thing.
Yeah.
And so I think this is probably, oh, and not only that, the rail station opened in Warwick about that time.
Right.
So. And so the with the opening of the railroad, it was very, very easy to take a train from London. And the American tourists absolutely flocked here. And we know that because we have visitor books, and you can see the visitor books here.
Oh, yeah.
And in our visitor books are just peppered with people who have come from Pittsburgh, USA, Chattanooga, here, USA, and you see all the way through that.
Yes, so we're actually looking at a facsimile, I guess, of a guest book. So we can see all the signatures. Another USA there.
A lot from Philadelphia. Where have we got? We've got Boston. We've got New York.
Oh, there's Boston and New York, yeah.
And then we have
Georgia.
So it's really quite fascinating. And as an American...
Oh, my goodness, somebody from Australia here.
Yep, someone from Australia. But the Americans loved it here.
Wow.
And they came and... so we've actually created a database of all the Americans that came here with their names on it. So if you're an American and you visit the Lord Leicester, you'd be able to plug in the town that you come from and your name and find out if you had any relatives from the past who came here.
Oh, wow, guys. You're going to have to come down, and if you're from the US and you're visiting, this is another reason why you must get down to the Lord Leicester. That would be so much fun. So we've got the privilege of going on a tour, as I mentioned, just as those as visitors today can do. So shall we head off and you can perhaps take us through, I think we're going to be going through some of the ages of the Lord Leicester and its evolution.
Yes, of course. Follow me.
Okay, let's go.
Thank you.
We've just come outside. It's a lovely... The sun has come out. It's beautiful, isn't it, for October? It's incredibly warm.
It is. This is a little sun trap. And out here, the frontage actually runs along the Guildhall. And the frontage is right on the High Street of Warwick. And it's we have tables and chairs outside where people who come to our cafe can sit outside under this extraordinary medieval building and then bask in this little sun trap that we have here. It's always warmer here than anywhere else
in Warwick. Beautiful. And I should say for those folk who are listening, as per usual, there will be a show notes page associated with this podcast, and we're going to take some photos as we go around so you'll be able to see some of the features and the buildings and the spaces that Heidi is showing us today. So do make sure you check out the description for that link. And this is, I mean, this is, it's gorgeous. I can see we're about to go under a gateway into an inner courtyard. We've got the lovely bear and ragged staff, which is, of course, Leicester's emblem and I presume his coronet above it.
Oh, yes. We are now walking into the medieval courtyard of the Lord Leicester. It's typical of medieval domestic courtyard architecture. One of the extraordinary things, Sarah, you said earlier that it's one of the most beautiful buildings in Warwick, and I would submit that it's probably one of the most beautiful medieval buildings in all of the British Isles.
I'm not going to contend with you, actually, and it's... It's everything you would want to see from a medieval courtyard.
And what when architects or architectural historians come here, they just sort of are a little speechless because from an architect's perspective who studied buildings in Britain, they always come away saying it is quite extraordinary how the craftsmen of the Middle Ages, the 1300s, were able to put up such a complex building in such a short time. It was put up over a period of about 40 years, from the late 1380s to about 1420, 1430. And to be able to haul all of the timbers from all across England, and we know that the timbers that made this building come from the New Forest, from Wales, from Kent,
really?
From Warwickshire. Yeah, we know that they come from all over England to be able to put them up just by, basically by hand. Is really quite extraordinary. And then the second thing they say is, and it must have been incredibly expensive to put this building up. Who was the person? Who was wealthy enough in Warwick to have enough money to pay all those labourers for 40 years and to pay for all the materials and put this building up in that period of time?
So we don't know who founded or was the patron of the Lord Leicester at the beginning.
We know that the guilds were given the land and the chapel by Richard II. And then they made a decision to build these buildings. Now, as to who actually was the patron and who paid for the buildings, we really don't have any evidence of who that person was. Almost certainly it was a patron, had a lot of money. Mm. It could have been that the guilds themselves, who were very wealthy, it was the Guild of St. George, they could have paid for a portion of the building. But there is a big question over who actually paid for it, because it was an extraordinary accomplishment for the medieval building. I mean, for medieval times, this site, this the footprint of this site is really very big.
Yes.
And very complex.
What kind of size of acreage do we cover with the buildings that exist?
2 acres, 3 acres,
okay.
4 acres. I'm not. It depends whether you include the gardens or not. But the point is that it encompasses a guild hall, two great medieval halls, living quarters for the master who lived in the master's house, administrative offices for the people who worked in the guild, lodgings where the monks and the different guilds members lived, and a chapel. So really, it's very complex for the medieval period. And it was truly, I think that the Guild of St. George in Warwick was very prominent, very important. And by building this extraordinary building, they were projecting that power and that influence to the town and surrounding areas of Warwick.
And the guilds were basically merchants, right?
The guilds are. I mean, the guilds are, you know, they rather than the nobility, who the nobility lived in Warwick Castle, controlled all the lands, was the king's man. But the guilds were very much about civic governance, about the commerce of the town. This particular guild, our records show this particular guild was more about the legal profession and business and commerce. There were some guilds that were about, they were builders, craftsmen, ironmongers, blacksmiths, but this particular guild here at the Lord Leicester was very much about commerce and the legal business of the town.
Right. And just, you know, we're standing right in the middle of the courtyard here, and you were just describing some of the buildings, but maybe we could just go round and just look at what we're looking at. So on one side, is this the Great Hall?
This is the Great Hall. This great hall was built in the early 1400s, and from the very, very beginning when the guild built it, it was designed to be a banqueting hall. It wasn't designed to be anything more than to go and have fun and drink ale, and also to look after travellers who had come through the West Gate into the town of Warwick, which was a walled town. We still have the part of the wall here on this site that you'll see later. But it was designed to welcome travellers into the Great Hall, where they could spend the night, where they can get food, be looked after. And I can't even imagine how many thousands of mugs of ale have been drunk in the Great Hall.
It's a great thought. It's a great thought.
But it's very much, it is a medieval hall with medieval beams. It's seen kings and queens who've been dined here and who visited. James I, when he came to Warwick, this is where, in this Great Hall, this is where he had his banquet, his three-day banquet. There was a fire at Warwick Castle, so he couldn't have the banquet there. He had it here in the Great Hall. And the town took 10 years to pay for James I's banquet.
For three days. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Ross had this way of bankrupting places that they visited.
I think it came close here in Warwick.
So basically this building is kind of half stone, half timber, and then over at right angles to that, on the other side of the courtyard, you were pointing out this is the master's house. Is this where you live?
Yes. As we move on round the courtyard, and the courtyard obviously is a square, as we move on, we come to the master's house. It is a little misleading because it's absolutely covered in Victorian bling. So when in the 1800s the Victorians did a big restoration project here, they decided that they would cover the front of the medieval master's house with a lot of adornments, as I call Victorian bling. So you've got the porcupine, the blue porcupine, the crest of the Sydney family, who are our current patrons of the Lord Leicester. You've got some lovely little animated bears taken from the bear, the emblem of the bear and ragged staff of Warwickshire. And then you've got Robert Dudley's bear and ragged staff emblem. And then a faux black and white half-timbered facade that's been put on the front of the buildings.
So that's a Victorian facade that's been added onto medieval buildings, essentially.
Yeah, and we've kept it that way because it is historically important. This was the Victorian age was a hugely important time in the history of the Lord Leicester, and it's fun. It's actually quite
it's very
fun.
Striking. I'll say it's very striking.
Yeah.
And then we move around again to the next range, and this looks much more authentic and original. We've got this fantastic timber framed gallery, and a walkway underneath it. I can see sort of very Tudoresque looking arches. Is this 16th century or is this even earlier? Is this back to the original sort of 1300s, 1400s?
This is truly, you know, the beams that you see are truly medieval, built, put up in late 1300s,
That's
early
amazing.
1400s. But then you've got some Tudor adornments. For example, you see the leaded light windows
over there?
Mm. That was definitely a Tudor addition. And they would have run actually all across the top here.
That makes sense, yes.
Yeah. So there's definitely, the Tudors have also had their hand in, in the facelifts of the Lord Leicester.
It's perfect. You don't see too many kind of galleries like that in such amazing condition. And I think that's not perhaps unique, but it's got to be one of just a handful in the country that are in as good a condition as that.
And as I said earlier, it's the reason why architects, architectural historians come here and they sort of look at it in amazement and say, you know, this has got to be in the top five of medieval buildings in Britain that are authentic and intact.
Yeah. And as you were saying before, this is kind of some of the administrative areas, and then on the top floor, sort of chambers, residential sort of areas there.
Yes. And
a lovely staircase going up to meet the gallery. So where do we need to go next, Heidi?
So the first place we will visit is after the courtyard, is the Guildhall.
Okay.
And the Guildhall is important in our historical chronology because this was the corporate headquarters, the kind of inner sanctum conference room of the guilds as they conducted business in Warwick.
I can't wait. So we are heading up the medieval staircase, as you can hear. Some fantastic, I presume, oak. And up into the first floor guild hall. This is fantastic. So it looks like a great hall in effect, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's really, you know, obviously it's got electric lights that highlight the medieval ceiling, and it's got some heaters hidden around, but it really is not changed or so different from the medieval period. You've got a long table that runs down the center of the room. The guilds would have sat around this table. And then as we look up into the ceiling, we see this lovely intricate medieval carvings high up in the ceiling, and these bosses that hang down from the ceiling.
Yeah.
And I love the story of the bosses, because whoever sits under it at the head of the table is the boss. So you can see at the end of the table is Thomas Oaken, who was the master of the guild in the 1500s, just before Robert Dudley arrived on the scene.
Right.
And we put him exactly under the boss, the carved boss high up in the ceiling, and everybody knows that he is the boss of the guild.
Yeah, it's such a high status room. It's fantastic. Now, maybe this is a good time to talk about a little bit about the restoration project, because obviously you've laid this out as if there was a guild meeting about to happen. As you say, you've got Thomas Oaken there who's heading the table. Maybe you could just tell us a little bit about the restoration that you've just kind of coming to the end of here at the Lord Leicester.
So we have been closed for almost 2 years, actually, to conduct a capital works project to repair, restore and improve the historical interpretation here at the Lord Leicester. And goodness me, it was really needed. I mean, you can see, sir, at the end of the Guild Hall there, that entire wall was about to fall into the path below.
Wow.
So what was fascinating about it was watching modern day workmen rebuild a medieval wall, because they have to insert exactly the right oak timber, and then they have to create the wattle and daub of the infill.
Mm-hmm.
And it was wonderful to watch outside as they mixed up the lime plaster and they sprinkled in goat hair, and then they came up here and they put it all on the lathes that they'd inserted between the timbers. So they worked very, very hard and diligently to really rebuild it in a traditional way.
That's fantastic. It's lovely that people still are around with those skills. Were they hard to find? Heidi's nodding and going, yep, they were hard to find.
Yeah, and I've got the most lovely little video. I would go out there and watch them sprinkling the goat hair. Say, is it goat hair today or is it horse hair? It's just the kind of hair we can get a hold of. So it was a wonderful thing to watch. But the restoration, we needed to do a lot of restoration of the fabric of the building. And, you know, old buildings like this, built in the 13th, chapel was built 900 years ago, and that's a different story because it's made of stone. But the half-timbered buildings, it is remarkable to me that they have needed so little restoration over the years. I mean, actually, until the Victorian age, we have no records of these buildings undergoing any sort of major restoration.
Mm.
And so it seems to be every 100 years there has to be a restoration
right.
of the buildings.
Mm.
And so the restoration, we restored the Guild Hall. We did a lot of work. I always say we did a lot of work under the floors, in the walls and on the roofs, because we had to replace a lot of 1950s wiring that was fire hazard. If we're having modern day heritage visitors come, they don't like to shiver their way through the tour. So we had to put in heating that was
hidden
away.
Yeah.
And in the Great Hall, we put it under the floor. So we have tried very, very hard to not only restore and protect the buildings, which is our responsibility, we're custodians of these buildings, but also to make it more fun and comfortable for heritage visitors who are going to come and see us.
It's really, you've done a fantastic job. So I would just have to say to our listeners, if you love rooms with sort of wonky floors and lovely sloping, I love the way this particular wall slopes outwards. It's fantastic, isn't it? The way it's all built, and it's just, as you say, they're so sturdy.
You also, Sarah, we deliberately...
Oh, yes.
Left gaps. The holes in the... there's this wonderful term called eavesdropping.
Ah, is that it?
And we're standing on an eave in the Guild Hall, and it actually cantilevers over the pathway below. And I could imagine in the medieval period, the guild sitting around the table conducting very important business, you know, such as is the cheese the right quality? Is the beer, you know, the right quality? And somebody underneath listening very intently to see up if they could pick up any tidbits through the hole through the hole in the floor. Hence the word expression eavesdropping.
Well, I hadn't heard that one. That's fantastic. Oh, it's lovely. And where do we go from here?
So after the Guild Hall, the Guild Hall, we put this first on our visit because it is about the guilds. This hall is about the guilds. And they were the ones that built the buildings. They were here for 200 years, over 200 years. This is where they conducted business. So it was very important that we did tell their story, not just the story of the Lord Leicester.
Right.
But from here, we now go into the room. It's called the Chaplain's Dining Room. And it is the room that describes how the buildings moved from the home of the guilds, the guilds owning the buildings, how they passed them to Robert Dudley, Earl of Leicester, this prominent, influential figure in the Elizabethan court.
Perfect. And we're going through a gorgeous oak-carved Tudor doorway. It's fantastic. So, Heidi, perhaps you could tell us what's going on in this space. It's obviously an exhibition space. So what are the stories you're trying to tell? What are some of the highlights you'd like to share with us?
Well, we've walked from the Guild Hall, which tells the story of the guilds, and we've walked into a room that tells the story of the Lord Leicester, how it was founded, the prominent figures that were involved in that, namely Robert Dudley and Queen Elizabeth I. And this room tells that story. And one of the things that I love about this room is a timeline. Now, it's definitely for history nerds. This is not someone who's just wandering around, but it's a very, very detailed timeline that shows the history, all of the history of the Lord Leicester, starting back in the 1100s when the chapel was built. And it goes through all the history, all the way up to the modern age. And prominently, very early on along the line, is this very big picture of Robert Dudley, Earl of Leicester, on the timeline. And that is because in 1571, when he rode into the town, he made the decision that he wanted his hospital, his philanthropic institution, to look after deserving poor. He wanted it to be in the buildings that belonged to the guild.
And I have to say, you've got a beautiful portrait of Robert Dudley in that room. That's an original?
Yes, it's original. It's painted 1588, later in life when he's
so almost older. Just before he died, actually.
Yeah, just before he died. And we think it was painted by Zucchero, but who obviously a prominent painter from the Tudor age. You know, Robert Dudley was... he was very good at self-branding because he had so many portraits painted of himself in the Tudor age, and we're lucky enough to have one of them.
So have you always owned that portrait? It's always belonged to the Lord Leicester?
As far as I'm aware, it's always been here at the Lord Leicester in position of prominence.
Wow.
And for a long time, it was up in my dining room, the master's dining room. And whenever I had dinner guests, and I would always insist that we stood and raised our glasses to our founder, Robert Dudley, Earl of Leicester, made a toast to our founder. We have now decided to put it in this room, the chaplain's dining room, that tells the story of Robert Dudley and the Tudor age and the founding of the Lord Leicester. And also a large part of this room tells the story of the relationship between Elizabeth I and Robert Dudley, Earl of Leicester.
Right. Perfect. Well, that's great. So having told the story of the Lord Leicester, where do we need to go next? What's the next space you'd like to take us into?
Well, so let's imagine then that the Lord Leicester has been established on Boxing Day in 1571, and Robert Dudley has moved the master in, who lives in the old house of the guild master, is now the house of the master of the Lord Leicester, and he's also moved in 12 brethren. So we now need to go downstairs into the room that was the kitchen commons for the brethren and tells the story of the brethren, 450 brethren who have lived here at the Lord Leicester.
Wow, brilliant. I'd love to see that. Let's go. I love the sign above the door, be kindly affectioned one towards another. A quick reminder.
That's the Elizabethan
part of the Elizabethan bling.
Is it?
Yeah.
Brilliant.
But these are Puritan principles. Yeah. And so you can see these written, honor all men, love the brotherhood. These are very much from these Puritan beliefs of Robert Dudley.
So we've come downstairs, down the staircase, and we've come into what originally you described as sort of almost like the service area and the residential area for the brethren. So where are we right now?
So we are now standing in a room called the Brethren's Kitchen. The Brethren didn't actually sleep in this room. They slept up in partitions in the Guild Hall. But this was the room where the cook worked.
Right.
And she cooked the food for the Brethren. And she looked after the Brethren. And they would come in here and smoke their pipes and drink their ale.
In front of a warm fire.
And they would have this beautiful Elizabethan cabinet over here that purportedly was given to the Brethren by Elizabeth I.
Right.
And a cabinet in which they could hang their robes. And it would be kept warm next to the fire.
And what a magnificent fireplace that is. That's a huge fireplace, very much. It's now got, a late Victorian range probably in it, but I could imagine a roaring fire back in the day.
Yes, I mean, this actually is a stove that was installed in 1854. It must have been a very modern, very impressive stove at the time.
Yeah.
But it was installed by Flavels, and the cook must have been absolutely delighted when she got this range, black wrought iron range to cook on. It must have been the ultimate in modern cooking appliances.
Totally. But the other thing you can't miss around it is obviously Leicester's motto, droit et loyal, and then you've got these dates, 1571. So we know that. Was that added later, or was this always been here?
I mean, the fire clearly has always been there, but I think again, this is again the Victorians, and adorning everything and referring back to Robert Dudley.
It's a great, space. Wow.
What's lovely, one of my most favourite things in this room is this list of the duties of the cook.
Oh, right.
The duties of the cook. This was found in the walls during our restoration recently, in the last few months. And it's signed by the master of the hospital, signed 1887.
Yes.
And it describes the rules for the cook and things like that she needs to attend to the boiling of the tea kettles. And she's not allowed to let any of the brethren dry their wet linens next to the kitchen fire. So it's very much a rule so that the cook can run her kitchen in an orderly way and make sure the brethren behave themselves in her kitchen.
And upstairs in the exhibition, you were showing me the rules of the house for the brethren. So this was a place that clearly had a lot of clarity. Everybody knew their roles and what they were supposed to be doing.
Absolutely. And remember, the brethren that Robert Dudley installed here, the 12 brethren, were actually military veterans. It was designed... The whole idea in Tudor England was to look after deserving poor, but who could be more deserving than the soldiers who had fought in the Elizabethan wars? And many came back from the wars losing a limb, losing their sight, and they really needed to have a sanctuary, a place of brotherhood where they could go and live for the rest of their life. And this is where many of them came. So it had it was very much a military community of men who had served and put their life on their line for their queen in the wars of Tudor England. And so it is run with sort of a military precision, with a lot of rules, but it worked. And they felt at home with that. You know, they felt comfortable with that. And you can actually hear in the background, we have a wonderful little story about Brother Abbott, one of our brothers who had fought in the Indian Wars.
He had fought in World War One. He participated in World War Two. So this man, all his life, had been about war, and he came back to live here at the Lord Leicester in later life, and lived here peacefully with his wife.
Oh wow! Yeah. So the brethren do move here with their families, their wife or wife and children, or you know, who tends to live here today, for example?
The brethren have always been able to come here with their wives and families, and we have wonderful stories about some brethren who, it's written up in the master's book, where they want to come and live here with their 11 children and the master's saying, goodness me, where are we going to put 11 children? And so there was a practice where they actually would the Lord Leicester, the money, the official money of the Lord Leicester would pay for them to have a house out in town.
I see.
And then they would come here and be based here.
Right. Courtyard now. You can probably hear the lovely gravel crunching under our feet. We're about to go through a door that is labelled the master's dining room. So we're into your side of the house then, Heidi.
Yes, this is my house. This is the master's house. And up until very recently, the room we're standing in was my private dining room.
Okay.
And the masters of the Lord Leicester, masters of the guilds, and then the masters of the Lord Leicester, this has been their dining room. And but I felt strongly that our heritage visitors who come here should also come in this room. But the
But also, it's really interesting when you sit down for Sunday lunch here in your dining room and you've got visitors visiting, yes, and they're looking through the leaded light windows at you. I thought, goodness me, they might as well just come in.
So this is where the portrait of Robert Dudley was for a long period. There's now a stag's head there. Yeah, that's very fitting. You've got some nice old drawings on either side, actually, of the stag's head of the
Lord Leicester.
Yeah, yeah.
So when the heyday of our visitors coming to the Lord Leicester in the 1800s, and we talked about the number of... Oh, can you hear the ghost creaking above?
I certainly can.
Yeah, it's a very old building. It's got to have ghosts. So you can hear them creaking above. But one of the things in the 1800s, the masters decided that they should have things for visitors to look at. And so we have one of the masters, Master Harris, decided he wanted to collect a lot of military-type artifacts to put up for people to see. And so some of them we have historical connections to.
Lovely
some of them are just purely just a collection.
That's a lovely halberd there to...
Yeah, so for example, here you've got a sword from 1642 from the English Civil War, the Edgehill sword.
Wow.
You've got pistols, Russian silver-mounted pistols. You've got halberds from the 15th century. So it was things that people like to look at, weapons that people like to look at. And then over here, we've got the board of all the masters who have served at the Lord Leicester. Been installed here right from the very beginning, 1571. And 1585, you have Thomas Cartwright, who is a leading revolutionary in the Tudor era.
Revolting against what?
He was the leading proponent in Tudor England of Puritanism.
Ah.
And the Queen wasn't very happy about that. She banished him for some time to Belgium. But Robert Dudley, as we've talked about, Robert Dudley was a huge believer in Puritan principles. Mm. And he looked after Thomas Cartwright. And after a while, he asked the Queen and said, could Thomas Cartwright come back to England? She said, absolutely not. And he completely ignored her, brought Thomas Cartwright back, installed him here in the master's house as the master of the Lord Leicester, and he was able to carry on his Puritan, promoting Puritan beliefs, and actually left his wife here in charge. So a lot of people say to me, you're not the first female master of the Lord Leicester. It was Thomas Cartwright's wife in the Tudor age.
Brilliant. Oh, great. I bet he kept his head down a little bit, though, if Elizabeth didn't know he was back in town.
Well, I suppose, you know, it speaks to how close Robert Dudley was to the Queen. I mean, she probably shook her head and said, oh, for goodness, he's at it again.
He's at it again, yeah.
So now we come into the Great Hall.
Okay.
This is our big, I talked about it earlier, big medieval hall, banqueting hall. And I think the highlight of this room really is the roof.
Yes.
During our recent restoration improvement, we put these lovely spotlights that shine up into the ceiling and show the intricate workmanship here that's above us.
It's beautiful, isn't it? And what a difference it makes with the right lighting.
Yeah, absolutely right. It also shows the dust and cobwebs, of course, which is not very easy to dust.
And original beams again?
Yeah, a lot of them are original beams, although that said, in the 1800s and in the 1950s, we went through a second restoration, a lot of the beams were repaired, rotten pieces taken out, inserts put in, but where possible, absolutely kept it as an original roof.
So a lot of feasting, as you said, a lot of ale consumed in here. And what are you using this space for today?
This is our cafe. So if you're, and it's open not just to our heritage visitors, but for the local community people.
Wow. Oh, great.
So it's open to everyone. The cafe is open to everyone. It was very popular here on Sunday. Our Sunday roast. And
you do a Sunday roast as well.
Yeah, we do a Sunday roast.
Oh, well
we have
done.
To do a Sunday roast in a banqueting hall.
Well, I see a Sunday roast and I see cakes. So, you know, coffee, cakes, Sunday roast and beautiful medieval and Tudor buildings. What more could you ask for? That's what I say.
Yep.
So next we're going to go up the stairs to the chapel, the absolute original building on this site.
And as we mentioned, I think, right at the top of the podcast, the chapel was built over the gate, the west gate of the town. So it's been there since.
Probably pre-1100s.
Right.
Warwick was a walled city. Mm. And this gate would have been the entry through that wall into one of the main gates into the town of Warwick.
And so, as you say, it still stands. That gateway, you can walk through it, you can walk underneath it. It's still there. And then you've got this beautiful chapel sitting
right on the top.
It makes an impression, I think, I would say, when you see it.
Yes, it certainly does.
And it was quite common, wasn't it, to have chapels over gates back in the medieval period, I think.
Yes, a lot of it was about... Well, this was built as a chantry chapel by Richard of Newburgh in the 1100s. And then it was restored in the 1300s by Thomas Beecham as a chantry chapel.
Right.
And then, he fell out of favour with Richard II. He was put in the Beecham Tower, and all his possessions, his lands and his wealth went to the king, and the king parcelled them out to various people. And the guilds were given this chapel, and they decided to restore it. Even more, but even more than that, they decided to build the rest of the site adjacent to the chapel.
Yeah, it's a really beautiful chapel. I haven't been in here for many, many years. Has this been part of your restoration, recent restoration?
Well, we've had some wonderful things added.
Oh, nice.
So we've had some music through the ages added. So when you come
beautiful.
In here, you can decide whether you want to play 12th century music, 13th century music, 14th, 15th century. We're listening to 15th century music at the moment.
I love that 15th idea.
15th and 16th century music. So, but actually most of the, I'm having fun here, but most of the restoration work was done in the tower. So a new lead roof, new flagpole. So it's really important work because the water was coming in.
It's absolutely beautiful. Does it ever get used in services?
I say prayers. The master of the Lord Leicester, one of the rules is that you say prayers every day in the chapel, and the brethren attend the prayer service. And the prayer, the reading of the prayer, is clearly influenced by Puritan beliefs.
Right.
So you see Robert Dudley's hand stretching all the way through the centuries up to the modern day where we're reciting prayers that he has approved. It's exactly the same prayer that he approved back in 1571.
I love that. I love that sense of continuity. It makes me feel very, very happy. So,
all right.
That brought us to the end of our tour?
Not quite.
Ah.
One little extra piece that you need to see.
That's lovely. That's lovely. I love that. What a great idea.
So the last bit of our tour that I wanted to show you is the medieval wall of Warwick, because I suspect you have not seen this and you didn't perhaps realise that it was here.
Is this it?
Yes.
Oh, wow. So no, I did not realise it was here. That's fantastic.
And there's a lot of people in Warwick who did not know that the medieval wall of Warwick, there is still quite a substantial piece of it, and it's here on the grounds of the Lord Leicester.
Oh, fantastic. Look at that. So it is.
So this, we believe, was built probably the original wall by Ethelfreda,
as a bulwark against the Danelaw. And the wall surrounded the town of Warwick. And we have records from the 1500s where town planners came here and were bemoaning the fact that so many people had stolen stones from the Warwick Wall, and so much so that a large part of it didn't exist anymore. So we have the wall here on our premises, and the walk along the medieval of Warwick takes us into the gardens.
Oh, right. Oh,
so we will on such head a that way.
Yeah, it's such a lovely sunny day. I think that's exactly where we should go. So I'm taking it, because there was a west gate, I'm imagining that Warwick had four gates, a north, a south, an east and a west. And that at some point, obviously, most of those walls were lost as they were. Many of them were starting to crumble around the Tudor period and were sort of lost soon after. Is that pretty much the case with Warwick, as far as you know?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, people were... These are great for building buildings, taking the stones out of the wall.
Yeah.
And because the fact that this is borders the grounds of the Lord Leicester. Oh, I got caught on a tree. These were protected. So we have been able to protect this wall because the Lord Leicester has been here.
And so now we're obviously outside, and I've just come under a green arbour and into a lovely, peaceful garden. It's so pretty.
So what you can see from here, Sarah, is the back of the master's house. And this is an interesting vantage point, because you see in the very center is the original medieval house. You can see the half timbers.
Absolutely.
Without that Victorian facade on it. But then either side, you have two Victorian wings.
Yeah.
The Victorians added this because they felt like the master's house should be bigger and grander.
Right.
That wasn't quite cut it, having just that medieval house in the middle.
Yeah.
Of course, in the medieval period, that would have been very, very grand, that particular house.
Absolutely, absolutely. Beautiful.
Yeah.
And so this garden is just part of the tour that people come on?
It is part of the tour. And it's interesting, because when Robert Dudley took over the buildings in 1571, the story goes that he came out into these gardens that existed at that time, and he looked around and said, "Let it remain as greensward for recreation."
Oh, lovely.
In other words, leave it as it is. Let the brethren and the master enjoy these gardens as they are. Don't change anything. Of course, what they did do, though, is that at the back here, you can see at the bottom part of the garden, they created these quadrants, these areas, that could be used for every brother had a strip of land where they could cultivate and grow their own vegetables.
Grow things, yeah.
And then they could pick the vegetables and take them into the cook in the brethren's kitchen, and she would put them in the pot for supper.
Fantastic.
Yeah. And there's lots of our records. There are lots of nice little stories where they're complaining that it's not fair that they don't have the strip of land that's closest to where the sun shines the most.
I can imagine that would be a source of contention. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh dear, that's really lovely. And you've got this lovely sort of idyllic green space in the centre of the town. People can no doubt hear the sounds of the town in the background, sirens and aeroplanes. But yet you've got this little haven here, this green haven with also the sounds of the birds.
Well, if we stop for a moment, we can hear the birds.
It's lovely.
And I always find it a place of extraordinary peace and quiet, because it is in the middle of the town, but then you have this area of green and peacefulness and quiet. And people very often come and just sit here and listening to the birds.
Yeah.
And we have a lot of bees and butterflies. We've tried to grow plants that will attract bees and butterflies. Mm. So yes, it certainly is.
It's lovely.
I hope Robert Dudley's happy with us that we kept it.
I'm sure he would
green as a place of recreation and peacefulness.
I'm sure he would be.
So we've just kind of wandered through the garden and we're now in a different area. It's a beautiful bird song that you can hear there, called the Knot Garden. And one of the things that is so striking is this unbelievably beautiful timber-framed house. Can you tell us a little about its history and why it's so special?
This is the Malt House. It is a Tudor building. Malt House because here they served alcohols made from malt. And I like to think that William Shakespeare travelled up the road from Stratford and up to London and stopped off here at the Malt House for a brew or two. But no, actually, what's significant, it is a beautiful half-timbered building, but what is particularly significant about the Knot Garden is the building right next to it, mm-hmm. right next to the Malt House. The building right next to the Knot House is where the Anchor Inn was located. And in 1694, so the story goes, a young man lit his torch in the embers of the Anchor Inn. He crossed the road over to the bakery on the other side of the high street. And as he did so, a wind sprung up from Stratford and took the sparks of his torch and started a fire on the other side of the road. And that fire swept through the whole of Warwick. And by 5 hours later, 250 families were homeless. Their homes had been burnt to the ground. And there was very little of medieval Warwick left. Yeah. The rest of it was in embers. Luckily, quite extraordinarily, the Lord Leicester escaped that fire.
Because it was on the right side of the wind, right?
It was on the right. The wind swept the fire westwards. And southwestwards, and we escaped the fire.
Incredible.
It was a miracle because the buildings are still intact today.
It is a miracle.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah, but so sad. I mean, that's just one of those just...
Which is interesting is why that you see in Warwick, the rest of the Warwick, all the way down the high street, all the buildings are built post-1694 in that Queen Anne style.
Yeah, and you just get the sporadic mm-hmm. timber frame building left. Yes, the Great Fire of Warwick, a tragedy for medieval Warwick and for us today, but you know, hey, if you're a fan of later buildings, then there's something to be said for it. Okay, lovely. Thank you. So I think that brings us to the end of our tour, but obviously there are going to be people now thinking, oh gosh, I really want to visit. If they haven't heard of the Lord Leicester before, they'll hopefully be wanting to put this on their itinerary. So where do people go to find out more information, and do they need to book tickets in advance? All that kind of good stuff, Heidi.
We have a website. It's called The Lord Leicester. You can book tickets online, but you can actually just come here and get a ticket and visit. And we're open from 10 o'clock in the morning till 4 in the afternoon. The only day that we're closed is on a Monday. And we are closed in January and February in the cold months.
Excellent.
When it's very difficult to heat a guild hall.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thanks for that. Honestly, it's been fantastic to come back. I haven't been here in many, many years. It's been such a joy to see the spaces again and after all the hard work that you have been doing here. So thank you for looking after this amazing building. And it's been a pleasure to be here today. Thanks so much, Heidi.
Well, it's great. Thank you for visiting us.
Well, that's a huge thank you to Heidi for being our guide today and for taking us round on such a fascinating tour. The buildings truly are exquisite, and I do hope that you enjoyed looking at some of the images as you listened to this podcast. Of course, there will be links to the Lord Leicester website in the description associated with this podcast, so make sure you check that out if you are planning a visit. Well, that's it for this month. I will be rejoining you, of course, in the month of May for yet another episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. So I'll see you on the road again soon. Thank Thank you for tuning in to today's episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. If you've loved the show, please take a moment to subscribe, like, and rate this podcast so that we can spread the Tudor love. Until next time, my friends, all that remains for me to say is happy time travelling!